Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you very much. Stephanie and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Connect workshop, update on mantle cell lymphoma. Today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations, and it really is because of that collaboration that we've been able to reach so many of you on the call today. Now, we have on the call today over 693 participants, and you come from all over the United States, and we also have international participants from Australia, Canada, and the United Kingdom. So you really come from all over the world, and we're delighted with your being on the call today. Today's program was made possible by Pharmaceutics, Inc., Janssen Biotech, Inc., and Celgene. And I really want to thank them for their support of the program today and also for their collaborative corporate support of the program. I want to turn your attention for a moment to all the materials you received from Cancer Care. In those materials, there is information about the topics to be covered and our speakers, about all the different collaborating organizations as resources for all of you. And we also have an evaluation form that I would ask you to please complete at the end of today's program. Your feedback to us is really very important. We appreciate your telling us the topics you'd like us to offer going forth. And we are planning many programs for the rest of this year, and your suggestions and recommendations really help to inform our programs and make them most relevant to meet your particular needs. So please tell us what you'd like. Indeed, the mantle cell programs that we've offered are really based on the fact that you've requested them, and so please tell us what you want us to do, and we'll try very hard to do it. Now, we have wonderful speakers on our program today, and I want to begin by introducing our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Owen O'Connor. And Dr. O'Connor is Professor of Medicine and Experimental Therapeutics. He's Director, Center for Lymphoid Malignancies, Department of Medicine. He's co-director, Program of Lymphoid Development and Malignancies, Herbert Irving Comprehensive Cancer Center, Columbia University Medical Center, the New York Presbyterian Hospital. And Dr. O'Connor is going to address mantle cell lymphoma overview, treatment options for newly diagnosed, and the role of clinical trials. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Dr. O'Connor.
Thank you very much, Carolyn, and welcome to everybody who's participating in the conference. I want to thank Cancer Care for their continued effort to help educate patients and caregivers about lymphoma in general. Mantle cell lymphoma is one of the more interesting subtypes of lymphoma that we've begun to really learn a lot about over the past decade or so. When you think about lymphoma, or at least when you think about non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, you're really talking about very complex and heterogeneous diseases. We recognize that there are probably about 70,000 cases of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma per year in the United States, and somewhere a little bit over 65 different subtypes. So many of these diseases are relatively rare, and in fact, when you talk about mantle cell lymphoma, we know that it comprises only about 6% of all cases of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, with an incidence of maybe 3,000 to 4,000 cases per year. If you compare that to sort of the top four or five other types of cancers like lung cancer, breast cancer, colon cancer, prostate cancer, those comprise in toto nearly a million cases per year. So we're talking about relatively rare diseases, and today you're going to hear from experts across the country that have a lot of experience managing these diseases, and this might be one of those diseases where getting the opinion of somebody who's involved in the research of the disease is really important. So the first thing I'm going to discuss is how do you think about treatment paradigms for mantle cell lymphoma? And right now there's a lot of controversy in the field about what to do. A lot of that controversy revolves around a big question, and that question is whether there is a role for doing an autologous stem cell transplant in what we refer to as first complete remission. Now there's also a little bit of controversy about what's the best chemotherapy to give for patients who have mantle cell lymphoma and how to get them into that complete remission, which then allows the auto transplant to be a little bit more effective. And at the moment, a lot of centers are advocating a role for autologous stem cell transplant in first remission, and many centers are using different regimens. The the regimen we use at Columbia is modeled after the Nordic Lymphoma Study Group, which utilizes a combination of a CHOP-like chemotherapy with Rituxan and interdigitated Ara-C. Other centers use hyper-CVAD. Some use some combination of CHOP-based chemotherapy. I think the jury is still out on what is the optimal therapy to use in first line in order to bridge patients to that transplant. But I think that depending upon the aggressiveness of the disease, autologous stem cell transplant seems to have a really favorable role in the long-term outcome of many patients with mantle cell. Now, those concepts are being challenged a little bit by a number of cooperative groups across the country that are exploring other new drug combinations without stem cell transplant. And those trials and those efforts are really oriented toward using a couple of new drugs that have recently been approved or are known to be very active in mantle cell lymphoma. One of those trials is a cooperative group study led by the Eastern Cooperative Group, ECOG, and they're actually looking at bendamustine to try to replace the CHOP chemotherapy that you heard me talk about earlier. And bendamustine is one drug, and there's some data to suggest that that one drug may equal the activity or be better than the activity of the four-drug regimens used in many forms of slower-growing non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. So the ECOG study is looking at the potential role for bendamustine with rituximab, and in those studies, they're also exploring the benefits of integrating another drug called bortezomib, which is a drug we helped develop many years ago that got an approval in mantle cell lymphoma. And what they're doing in that study that's really unique and may challenge the idea of doing a transplant in some patients is they're randomizing patients to some form of maintenance therapy. That maintenance therapy can consist of rituximab or can consist of another drug called lenalidomide, which was recently approved last June for patients with mantle cell lymphoma. And both of those drugs we know to be very active. And it is unclear whether giving those drugs after your upfront chemotherapy is going to have a long-term benefit. But it's an interesting concept, and trying to use these drugs in combination, it's conceivable that we may bypass the need to do autologous transplant, though I think it's going to take us many years to figure out whether those maintenance therapies or the novel induction chemotherapies with bendamustine and or bortezomib are going to make that difference. I think it's important to point out that mantle cell lymphoma, like many other kinds of lymphoma that we're taking care of today, is not one disease. It's a very heterogeneous disease. And we actually now know that there may be some forms of mantle cell lymphoma that are somewhat more indolent. And one of the features of the cells that we actually look at to try to make a judgment about how aggressive your mantle cell lymphoma is something called the Ki-67 index. The Ki-67 index is basically a measure of how fast your cells are dividing. And there's some recent data to suggest that patients with mantle cell lymphoma that's actually growing very, very slowly, and we now know there can be a significant fraction of patients that have this slower growing variant of mantle cell lymphoma, can oftentimes be managed the way we might manage other more indolent types of lymphoma like follicular lymphoma or small lymphocytic lymphoma. And that means that those patients may not necessarily require a transplant in first remission, may not even necessarily require combination chemotherapy. In some cases, they can be monitored a little bit more conservatively. In some cases, for patients that have some symptomatic disease, it may be feasible to treat them more conservatively with a drug like rituximab. I think that the community is still struggling with how best to first define those kinds of patients that have this slower growing versus faster growing forms of mantle cell lymphoma, and then to think about the kinds of clinical trials we can do which will help guide the practice of your oncologist in terms of thinking about what's the best therapy for patient with fast growing disease and what's the best way to manage a patient with slower growing disease. So many physicians around the country are taking a conservative approach when it comes to managing patients that have these slower forms of mantle cell lymphoma. It's actually an important issue to discuss with your treating physician so that you can better understand the kind of disease you have and the indications for treatment. I think what's really clear, and you're going to hear this theme yet again and again and again, and that is when you have a rare disease like mantle cell lymphoma, and it's very hard to develop dogmatic opinions about what to do and how best to treat, because doing clinical trials in this setting can be an enormous challenge. No one investigator in the country will see a sufficient number of cases to be able to accrue a clinical trial, and clinical research and clinical trials are our best avenue to try to formulate new concepts on how to treat the disease and how to treat different variations of the disease. That might be fast-growing disease versus slower-growing disease. So right now, nationally, there are a number of very, very important clinical trials that are offered to patients who are newly diagnosed with mantle cell lymphoma. And if you are such a patient, I actually would strongly encourage you to explore those trials. In some cases, you may not live close enough to one of the centers that's offering them, or in other cases, you might, or it might be a little bit of a commute to get there. But I think that the onus is on the patient to try to explore those sorts of options, independent of even the recommendations of your own physician. It's an important feature of this disease to try to get second opinions and try to explore what treatment options are out there for you, because I think that the clinical research and clinical trials that are now being developed in this disease really do have a chance to be paradigm-changing and really forge new concepts and new ideas about how best to treat the disease and, in fact, how best to tailor the therapy for any one patient. So you're going to hear a lot more from my colleagues in a moment about a lot of the new exciting therapies for relapse disease and alternative therapies, but the treatment of patients in the frontline setting is one where we've made enormous progress over the last 10 years, and I think there's no question that patients with mantle cell lymphoma today are doing better and better and better as our research continues to improve. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. O'Connor. Outstanding presentation, and really really setting the stage for today's program, and also letting everyone know about all the advances and highlighting all the advances that we're going to hear more about in mantle cell lymphoma treatment. Thank you. And our next speaker is Dr. Leo Gordon. And Dr. Gordon is Abby and John Friend, Professor of Cancer Research, Professor of Medicine, Director of Lymphoma Program. He's Medical Director, John and Lillian Matthews, Cellular Therapy Laboratory, Division of Hematology Oncology, Robert H. Lurie, Comprehensive Cancer Center, Northwestern University, Feinberg School of Medicine. And Dr. Gordon is going to be addressing treatment options for relapsed refractory disease, how research contributes to your treatment options, and managing treatment side effects. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Dr. Gordon.
From Dr. O'Connor, some of the initial upfront treatments and some of the controversies about upfront treatments. And we're hopeful that with some of these, with many of these, patients continue to do well, especially after autologous transplant or after they get a chemotherapy regimen without autologous transplant and perhaps are on a maintenance course of Rituxan. There are some data from our German colleagues suggesting that there's an advantage to maintenance treatment after R-CHOP chemotherapy for patients with mantle cell lymphoma. But there are patients who recur, and whereas perhaps 5 years ago there weren't a lot of options for those patients, the field has moved in a very dramatic and exciting way based on some of the research that Dr. O'Connor alluded to. And we now have a number of options, and we don't view in any way this is a hopeless situation for people who have recurrence. There are many options for treatment. One of those, certainly so there are two situations where patients may relapse. They may relapse after a transplant where they've been free of disease for several years, 3, 4, or 5 years, or they may relapse while they're on maintenance Rituxan. For those patients who relapse after a transplant, haven't been on any treatment, there are new, different chemotherapy regimens. Dr. O'Connor alluded to the drug bortezomib, which he helped to develop and has been approved for the use in this disease. That's a drug that's given usually either once a week or twice a week for a period of anywhere from 12 to 16 weeks, has good activity in mantle cell lymphoma, and patients do achieve good responses. There are some side effects, though. Neuropathy is the main one, where people get numbness and tingling in hands and feet. And that sometimes can be a dose-limiting toxicity, but we've seen very dramatic responses with that drug. Also recently approved is the drug Revlimid or lenalidomide. And this is a drug which begins to take advantage of the immune system and manipulating the body's immune system to try and fight the disease. This is a drug that's given orally, and it's a drug that's derived from its cousin, thalidomide, which many of you know of as a drug that was used in the 50s and 60s as a sleeping aid, caused birth defects, and was really pulled appropriately off the market. But that drug and its cousin, Revlimid or lenalidomide, have many good immune effects in patients with malignancies, and these are being re-explored now, especially in the treatment of mantle cell lymphoma. We have patients who have been on Revlimid for a good period of time and have had excellent responses to that drug. More recently, really this past November of 2013, the drug ibrutinib or Imbruvica was approved for the treatment of mantle cell lymphoma. And this is an exciting drug that represents major advances in understanding the basic biology of both mantle cell lymphoma and other non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. It was recognized that there is a sequence of events that occur in B cells initiated by something called the B cell receptor, which is on the surface of the cell, and that leads to a cascade of activation of certain proteins that lead to the cell to cell growth. One of those proteins is something that we call Bruton's tyrosine kinase, or BTK, which is an important component of cell B cell growth and B cell development. And then several years ago, investigators synthesized a compound which is ibrutinib, that inhibited this BTK. And this is really the first of its kind. It binds specifically to an amino acid in the BTK. And the beauty of this drug is that it's very well tolerated. It's a pill, which people can take every day. The side effect profile of this is very, very acceptable. Most of the side effects are minimal. People get sometimes mild diarrhea or maybe a little bit of fatigue in the beginning of treatment. But in general, this is tolerated very much better than most of the very aggressive chemotherapy programs that we use for upfront treatment. So we've seen, and in work that's been published very recently, upwards of 70% of patients having dramatic responses, and somewhere close to 50% of those are complete remissions, where people have had many prior treatments and getting complete remissions with this well-tolerated drug. So we view, I think, ibrutinib as one of the major advances in this disease and probably would be one of the early second-line treatments for patients who relapse. The side effect profile, as I mentioned, is fairly favorable and relatively easy to manage. One of the questions comes is whether this ibrutinib should be combined with other drugs, like, for example, Rituxan, or some of the other drugs that I alluded to. And those are questions that are being addressed in ongoing clinical trials. We worry when we give a drug like ibrutinib that there'll be some mutations that occur that make the drug no longer effective. And so we need to begin looking at ways to bypass those mutations, perhaps by combining it with other drugs. Another option for treatment, there's a drug called temsirolimus, which is approved in Europe but not in the U.S. for the treatment of mantle cell lymphoma, and that's a drug that also targets certain pathways. And you'll see this as a recurring theme in the development of new treatments for mantle cell lymphoma and other lymphomas that we're targeting specific pathways with drugs that are called small molecule inhibitors like these drugs we're talking about. And these have had quite a bit of activity with minimal toxicity. And then finally, there is still the possibility of either a second transplant for patients that have had prior transplant or what's called an allogeneic transplant, where the transplant is done from a sibling, where you have the advantage of the chemotherapy, plus you have the advantage of the immune cells from your donor attacking the lymphoma. And that might be another way, although that type of treatment is much more toxic, but that might be a potentially curative treatment for patients who relapse. And I think, again, as Dr. O'Connor pointed out, the optimal combination and the optimal regimen isn't known yet. And none of us see enough patients to make those conclusions by ourselves, and that's why clinical trials taking advantage of the basic science research that's been going on in this disease is so critical. So once again, I would encourage patients, especially those who might have relapsed, to explore the possibility of clinical trials, even if it's not at your own institution. So I'll stop at this point and turn the over to Dr. Messner once again.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Gordon. That was really excellent and quite outstanding and lots of wonderful information for everybody. And I know there will be questions for you during the Q&A. Thank you. Our next speaker is Dr. Ajay Gopal. And Dr. Gopal is Associate Professor of Medicine, Division of Medical Oncology, University of Washington, Member of Clinical Research Division, Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center, Clinical Research Director, Hematologic Malignancies and Hematology, Seattle Cancer Care Alliance. And Dr. Gopal is going to address emerging treatment approaches, your comfort level of adherence, and benefits of communicating with your healthcare team, key questions to ask. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Dr. Gopal.
I'd like to start by thanking Dr. Messner and also thanking Cancer Care for the opportunity to speak and providing this educational opportunity. Much of what I say, I think, is going to echo some of the comments by my colleagues, Dr. Gordon and Dr. O'Connor, regarding mantle cell lymphoma, really emphasizing that it's really quite an exciting time in the setting of treatment of mantle cell lymphoma. If we think back to really in the 90s, we didn't even recognize this as a separate disease. And over the last decade or two, we've understood the biology of mantle cell lymphoma better to design these targeted therapies that specifically address the problems that occur in these malignant cells, as opposed to a really much more of a blunt instrument of traditional chemotherapy. So this really leads to discussion of emerging treatment approaches. And when I talk to my patients, I say to them that this is a much longer discussion now, and I think it's a pleasure to have a longer discussion because there are lots of options, though we don't yet know what the proper sequence is. But many of the new therapies that Dr. Gordon reviewed were emerging therapies really as short as less than a year ago. And these emerging therapies are often best accessed by participating in clinical trials. And I think really, as my colleagues have stated, I can't overemphasize the importance, particularly if this lymphoma has recurred, to consider clinical trial options where appropriate. So the drug ibrutinib was just approved less than a year ago, and this drug was only available in the clinical trial setting. And if we were having this conversation a year ago, this would be considered an emerging therapy, whereas now it is available therapy. But with our increased understanding of the biology of mantle cell lymphoma and B-cell malignancies in general, there are a variety of other agents, and I'm just going to touch on a few that are on the horizon and hopefully will be on our hands outside of the clinical trial setting in the years to come. One agent is a drug called ABT-199. This is a specific oral therapy. It's a pill that targets the resistance of cancer cells to die. It targets something called BCL2, and this protein, when it's overexpressed, prevents the cells from dying. So this drug, in early studies, appears to be very promising and have significant anti-mantle cell lymphoma activity. There's also another drug, which is a pill, which does target that similar B-cell receptor signaling pathway that Dr. O'Connor and Dr. Gordon mentioned, called idelalisib. And there also are some preliminary data suggesting that this drug can have significant anti-tumor activity with a very modest side effect profile. So these are some of the emerging types of therapies in terms of novel agents that are available in clinical trials. As Dr. Gordon alluded to, mantle cell lymphoma is also one of the cancers where we know the immune system plays a considerable role. And we have learned through treatments such as non-ablative allogeneic transplant, this is a stem cell transplant from a donor, which could be a sibling or an unrelated donor or another family member, that the immune system can eradicate the tumor. And it does offer the potential for cure, albeit with somewhat of a higher risk in terms of the treatment. Along those lines, emerging therapies include a more engineered strategy to target the malignancy, namely taking out the immune cells out of one's body and re-engineering them to go back and attack the tumor cells. And this is commonly known as CAR T cells or CARTs, and there are a variety of centers around the country that are pursuing this strategy with the hopes to have better options for patients with recurrent mantle cell lymphoma. So what I often tell my patients is that my goal as their physician is to try to stay one or two steps ahead of the game with their malignancy. And my bias, and I think many of my colleagues' bias, that in this setting, one of the best ways to do this is to consider these emerging therapies in a clinical trial setting, knowing that drugs such as ibrutinib and lenalidomide, for example, are available and there, but clinical trials offer even additional options to have access to some of these most promising emerging therapies. Another consideration when one discusses treatment options is comfort level with adherence. And you've heard from my colleagues regarding a variety of options, which range from very intensive therapies such as high-dose therapy and autologous transplantation, which some studies have certainly suggested that this improves long-term outcomes when done in the initial after the initial remission. Versus very mild chronic therapies, which might be subcutaneous injections or pills, but does mean that somebody may have to be on therapy chronically. And I think it's important to remember that each of these approaches have their pros and cons, and certainly with a chronic therapy, adherence is going to be important. Certainly, in order for these therapies to work, one has to take the drugs and stay on therapy. So these points are important to consider when you have your discussion with your provider. For example, a more intensive therapy might be able to give you a long period of time off therapy in between therapies, but may come with more side effects while you're on therapy. This is in contrast to a chronic therapy, which may have less side effects at any given time, but is administered over a long period of time. And I think these are things that one has to discuss with their healthcare provider. Which really brings us to the final point of benefits of communicating with your healthcare team and key questions to ask. I don't think there's any one specific question, but first I think one of the things one should do is ask questions to oneself regarding whether one wants to be aggressive and have an intensive therapy, which may offer a long remission and a long period off therapy, as I mentioned, or is a more chronic but gentle therapy more appropriate or more preferable for a given individual. And this leads to questions that one should ask their physician. As a number of us had mentioned, first asking, are clinical trials available for my situation? And I think that's really a key question that my colleagues have also said. And then, if yes, are these appropriate for me? I think we all know that there are a variety of trials, but we try to recommend the ones that are most appropriate for our patient's given situation. When one's newly diagnosed, as Dr. O'Connor alluded to, the first question may be, do I need therapy at this time, or is this a very indolent situation that could just be observed for a period of time? And when there are, when treatment is required, what are the pros and cons of each strategy? Are there data saying that one therapy is clearly better than another? And I think this is a challenge in a rare disease because it's very hard to do large trials comparing different therapies head to head. Another question to ask is, am I a candidate for an autologous stem cell transplant? Is that something that might be appropriate for me based on my age or other medical conditions? Is that something that would be safe for me? And if the disease recurs, also asking the question, am I a candidate for an allogeneic transplant? And discussing the pros and cons. Do I have a donor? Do I understand the risks that are involved and the potential benefits of going for this therapy that has a chance for cure but also has a chance for toxicities and side effects? And very specifically asking questions about the various risks and benefits for any given therapy. So to summarize, this is really a very exciting time in mantle cell lymphoma. When I visit with patients now compared to my meetings with patients a decade ago, it's a much longer consult and a very much longer discussion, but it's really a pleasure to be able to have so many options that are in our hands and additional options that are in clinical trials. It does make it a challenge in terms of choosing, and I think none of us know the right single option, but it's always good to have more choice. So with that, I will conclude and turn it back over to Dr. Messner.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Gopal. That was a wonderful presentation and a lot of excellent points for everyone to consider, and I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A, and thank you so much. And our next speaker is Ms. Anna Eckhart. Ms. Eckhart is an oncology social worker. She's a coordinator of our online services at Cancer Care, and she'll be addressing Cancer Care's free professional psychosocial support services and the role of support groups. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Ms. Eckhart.
Thank you, Carolyn. It's really wonderful to be part of this important conversation about helping patients and loved ones cope with and attempt to understand mantle cell lymphoma. I'd like to begin by speaking broadly and then more specifically about our services. There are many ways cancer care can be part of your network, and there are many ways we can help. Adjusting to and dealing with the diagnosis is an important part of the healing process, and as social workers, we would argue that it is an essential part. So here at Cancer Care, we are a national nonprofit organization, and like Carolyn said, we provide free professional support services to anyone affected by cancer. All of our services are provided by licensed, master's-level oncology social workers and are completely free of charge. So oncology social workers, like me, are trained in how a diagnosis of cancer affects a person and his or her family and friends. We're also trained to help people with cancer and their families tackle the problems that accompany the disease, such as the financial demands, the physical changes, social adjustment, and psychological impact, and overall care. Additionally, we provide education about resources and how to navigate the healthcare system, help you find practical help, and discuss some limited financial assistance, such as how to apply for chemo copay assistance. I want to also talk about the importance of creating a support network when you're diagnosed with cancer or caring for someone with cancer. Asking for help by joining a support group or by contacting a social worker for counseling is a sign of strength. You do not have to walk this path alone. Joining a support group is a way to connect with others who are going through a similar situation or have similar problems. You can share experiences and learn from each other. Group members provide a listening ear and share tips and resources they've utilized along the way. And cancer care support groups are moderated by us, the oncology social workers. Additionally, we offer face-to-face groups as well as telephone and online groups. And currently, for those who are diagnosed with lymphomas, we offer an online blood cancer support group. This 15-week online support group is for people diagnosed with a blood cancer who are currently receiving treatment. The online support groups allow people from all over the world to write and share about their cancer experiences. And by visiting our website at cancercare.org, cancercare.org, is the first step in the registration and screening for this and all of our online groups. Caregivers can access support through our telephone and online caregiver support groups, and these groups provide a safe, supportive environment for sharing your feelings and discussing the challenges and rewards of being a caregiver. Additionally, we have a unique young adult program, and we offer both a patient and caregiver online support group for people between the ages of 20 and 39 who are currently dealing with a cancer diagnosis. And if you choose to pursue individual counseling, this type of support provides a space that is just yours to voice any concerns. All these connections help lessen the isolation that many people with cancer experience, and feeling well emotionally can help you better deal with the diagnosis and treatment. So, again, if you're interested in any of our cancer care services, our hope line is 1-800-813-4673. Or if it's the online support group that interests you, then visit our website at cancercare.org. Please remember that you are not alone. Our services are there to help you. Thank you for your attention and the opportunity to talk with you today.
Well, thank you so much, Anna. That was a wonderful description of the service of cancer care, and we hope that people will take advantage of them and utilize all the services, both of cancer care and all of our collaborating organizations as well. And now we have time for questions. We actually have a lot of time for questions. I'm going to ask Stephanie to explain to all of you how to queue up for questions. I see there are already some online, but Stephanie will let you all know how to queue up for questions, and we'll take as many of your questions as possible. If we don't get your question, please, or you think of a question in a couple of days, just call us at Cancer Care at 1-800-813-HOPE, and I'll give you that number again, but let's move ahead and see how many of your questions we can take. Stephanie, could you explain how to queue up for questions?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star then one on your touchtone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question. Our first question comes from Norman S. Your line is open. Norman, your line is open.
Hello.
Hi. Do you have a question you'd like to ask us?
Yes. I'm in the middle of a bendamustine rituximab treatment, and I've had three treatments now for what's been so far a very indolent mantle cell lymphoma, which was kind of unusual in that it appeared first in my eyelids, and I had radiation for it, and now it's activating in several other places in my body, including my colon, so my doctor decided to go ahead and treat. My question is, I've had three of those treatments, and she just did a colonoscopy to see if it was working in my colon. And there was shrinkage in my colon, but not quite as much as she wanted to see. So my question is, how does one know whether to continue, and this is what my oncologist is considering, with that treatment, or to switch me midway to ibrutinib, which I know is a good treatment, but I'm wondering if I waited down the line, if I could get enough remission from the rituximab bendamustine treatment down the line, the ibrutinib, as many of the doctors suggested, they'd have a better idea what other agents work with it. So my question is kind of, how do I know what to do at this point?
Well, thank you. That's an excellent question. I'm going to ask Dr. O'Connor to address your question in a general way, because, of course, he can't give you an absolute answer for your particular situation on the telephone. And then we hope you'll take that information back to your treating healthcare team. But I think he may be able to give you some just ideas, or everybody some ideas of how to think about this, because obviously your question may be one that others worry about as well. Dr. O'Connor?
Thanks, Carolyn. Obviously, it's very hard for me to comment on a given case, because the devil's in the detail, and you need to look at all aspects of the response and how much disease you had in the beginning, but I'll just make some broad comments. One is, if there's a sense that you're responding well to the therapy based on the CAT scan and the PET scan, then usually the tendency will be to try to complete that therapy. If in some cases you may have had a very good response of your lymph nodes or in your bone marrow, but they do a colonoscopy and they still find some trace of disease. Now, when you say disease to guys like us, that could mean, well, there's a big tumor there. That could mean that there's inflammation or thickening of the intestine, or it could mean that there's no obvious evidence of disease. And when the gastroenterologist does a colonoscopy and does a biopsy, they see some trace amounts of disease. Now, I have to say, this may be one of those other controversial areas in terms of us not having a lot of great data to guide what to do. I have had many patients over the years who have had colonoscopies and biopsies and were found to have mantle cell lymphoma, but that was the only site of disease that they had, and that disease tended to be slower growing disease. They had no complications of the disease, no symptoms, and some of those patients we've just watched. I think it's a unclear issue as to how to evaluate residual disease in the gastrointestinal tract, which is clearly a place where mantle cell lymphoma loves to live, and making it somewhat unique amongst the lymphomas, and how to manage that. And I think it comes down to trying to evaluate how much disease did you have there in the beginning and how much do we think you have now. If you have a biopsy that shows trace amounts of disease and you're completely asymptomatic, it's not clear to me that that would necessarily need treatment, but it needs to be assessed on a case-by-case basis. Involvement of the GI tract and response of disease in the GI tract, for me, continues to represent a challenge in how we fully evaluate any one patient's response to treatment, and it's something that needs to really be critically evaluated in a detailed way on a case-by-case basis.
Thank you. So we hope this is helpful to you and that you'll bring this information back to your treating healthcare team. Thank you. And we have a question from one of our online participants, and the question is, can you repeat any previous treatments after you have a relapse? For example, if you get a complete response with ibrutinib and then it comes back at some later point, at some point later, can you try it again? Dr. Gordon, can you address this question in a general way, again, because it is specific, but just give some general guidelines regarding this question?
Correct, right. So, again, in general, decisions about retreatment depend a lot on a couple of things. First of all, what the initial treatment was, and then what the interval was between the initial treatment and the recurrence. So, for example, if the initial treatment was hyper-CVAT, so an aggressive chemotherapy regimen with some Adriamycin in it, we know that there's a dose limitation to the Adriamycin. So it's not likely that people would be able to repeat hyper-CVAT a second time. That's rarely done. Similarly, rituxan-bendamustine. Bendamustine is an excellent drug, but there's cumulative toxicity to the bone marrow with bendamustine, and it's difficult to imagine patients being able to get more than the perhaps 5-6 cycles that they initially get. So that's a drug that's, again, difficult to repeat, I think. Ibrutinib is an open question because we don't know the answer to it with ibrutinib because the studies with ibrutinib are so recent. At most, there's probably people been on it for 2 years. And most of those patients on the original trials stayed on it until they progressed. So there isn't a lot of experience with starting it, stopping it, and then restarting it. There are some drugs, however, which maybe can be resumed after a long interval. Velcade, if the neuropathy with it in the beginning isn't so great, can be repeated. Revlimid, very often people will stay on that, but if people have had a good response, come off of it, and then recur again, you could theoretically repeat Revlimid. And so I think a lot, in general, a lot depends on what the interval was, what the initial drugs were, before making that determination. So.
Excellent. Thank you. We have actually another question from one of our online participants, and the question is, with the genome sequencing, could it be determined that my lymphoma cells are indolent or aggressive, and would a genome sequencing be beneficial for designing a treatment plan? I'm going to repeat the question. With the genome sequencing, could it be determined that my lymphoma cells are indolent or aggressive, and would genome sequencing be beneficial for designing a treatment plan? Dr. Gopal, could you address that question?
I think that's an excellent question, and I think that it's certainly where we want to be in the years to come. As I think Dr. O'Connor alluded to, probably the best thing under the microscope or with anything more than just our clinical bedside judgment in terms of predicting the aggressiveness of mantle cell lymphoma is this test called a Ki-67, which tells you how fast the cells are dividing. There have been genetic signatures that are associated with outcome in mantle cell lymphoma and other lymphomas. There are also tests that are often done at many centers that suggest certain genetic abnormalities. But at this point in time, I don't think we have enough knowledge to know if those are actionable in terms of choosing a specific therapy or stating whether one should initiate therapy or not. In the setting of observing versus treating, one option is to if the disease is not behaving clinically aggressively, to observe and really just follow very closely over time. Data from Cornell, as well as some data from our center, as well as other places, have shown that an initial observation period is not necessarily detrimental, and that can also give you an idea about how aggressive, clinically aggressive, a given mantle cell lymphoma may be.
Well, thank you. And actually, there's a question, another online question about the Ki-67 index. The question is, how is the Ki-67 index measured? Is it via a blood test? Is this done in routine practice? Dr. Gopal, would you address this? Even though you addressed it, if you could just say a bit more about it.
Right. So this is a test that's usually done on the actual biopsy tissue. It's a special stain that one does on ideally a lymph node that has the mantle cell lymphoma in it. And cells that are dividing are stained darkly with this Ki-67 test, and you can basically count up the cells and see how many are actively dividing. So it's not a blood test. It's a test that's done on the biopsy tissue.
Thank you very much. Thanks for that clarification. Thank you. Another question from one of our online participants who are very actively asking us questions today. Here's a question. What are the most common dangers associated with stem cell transplants? Dr. Gordon, could you address that?
Sure. So there are two kinds of stem cell transplants. One is when the donor is yourself. When you're the donor, you give your own cells, you harvest your own stem cells, freeze them, and then receive higher doses of chemotherapy and possibly radiation than you could otherwise receive, and then those cells are reinfused afterwards. The dangers there are mostly associated with that period of roughly a month or so where your blood counts are low before the blood counts have recovered. So the risk there is infection, sores in the mouth, and the immediate transplant period. And once people recover from that period, say it's 3 or 4 weeks, they slowly regain strength, and it's unusual to have late or long-term complications from that. The other kind of transplant is what's called an allogeneic stem cell transplant, where the donor is either a sibling, each sibling has about a 25% chance of being a match, or the donor might be an unrelated donor obtained from a pool of over 14 million people worldwide who might be a match, and a third type of donor might actually be umbilical cord. And in those kinds of transplants, there's much more effect on the immune system. So patients have to receive therapy that reduces the immune system, and they become more susceptible to infection. And then the other thing that can happen with an allogeneic stem cell transplant is something called graft versus host disease, where the donor cells recognize the host, that's the patient, cells as being foreign and cause skin problems, liver problems. That's a double-edged sword, though, because on the good side, those donor cells also recognize the lymphoma cells as being foreign and so attack the lymphoma cells. So there's this balance that you get. You'd like to get some graft versus host disease, but not too much. But the graft versus host disease and the infection risk are the most difficult things to control in the allogeneic stem cell transplant. That's what makes it somewhat more risky in general, a more risky procedure.
Excellent. Thank you. Thank you very much. Our next question, Stephanie, from telephone caller.
Our next question comes from Dennis G. Your line is open.
In an autologous stem cell transplant, my own blood that has been harvested certainly contains some remaining undetectable cancer cells. How are these removed, or how can you prevent my own blood from giving me the disease back?
Thank you, Dennis. That's an excellent question. Dr. Gordon and Dr. Gopal, can you both address that question?
Right. Well, okay. I think it's an excellent question, and it's always a concern when you're doing an autologous stem cell transplant. The question still remains really whether those cells are viable, whether you can actually give back the disease with an autologous stem cell transplant. Many people believe, and this has been looked at, many people believe that the reason there's a recurrence isn't so much that you're giving back those cells, because they're still a probably, if they're there at all, they're probably a relatively small number, but rather the disease itself has been resistant. People have tried to purge, if you will, those cells from the stem cells that are given back, but most of those attempts either haven't been successful or have led to delayed engraftment. So we usually don't collect stem cells in people where there's an extensive amount of disease. It's one of the reasons we like to collect the stem cells after there's been some treatment and the disease has gone into remission, or we can really minimize the amount, the number of stem cells. So that is one reason, though, to consider an allogeneic transplant if the disease, you're having trouble getting the disease in remission and you're still thinking about a transplant. An allogeneic transplant might be an option for that reason, but you have to weigh the toxicities of the two. AJ, would you have any other comments?
I would concur with that. I think it's a good question, and I think the data to date have not borne out that any purging mechanism or approach has improved the outcome. I will say that we're now using a rituximab or other monoclonals, the blood tends to have pretty low levels or really undetectable levels by the best testing we have of the mantle cell lymphoma. Even if there may still be some residual lymphoma in the lymph nodes, the blood is quite well purged, at least to the best of our detection, but I think the bigger challenge is eradicating the lymphoma within the patient.
Thank you very much. And we have another question from one of our online participants. What are your thoughts on PET CAT scans as compared to molecular testing in monitoring the disease? Dr. O'Connor, could you address that question?
Well, the CT PET scan is the addition of the PET scan actually adds a little bit of sensitivity in terms of our ability to find disease, because one of the things it measures is this increase in metabolism within the disease relative to other normal body tissues. Most would say that if your PET scan becomes negative, it may be very useful in the beginning in terms of trying to fully evaluate the extent of your disease. And if a positive in the beginning and you get some therapy that then makes the PET scan negative, i.e. you don't have any metabolic evidence of disease, you really wouldn't get the PET scan again unless there was a clinical indication to do so, i.e. the physician thought you might be relapsing or have disease that's become more resistant to the chemotherapy. So the PET scan has a role up front, perhaps, in trying to fully evaluate that extent of disease, but should it be positive in the beginning, and should it become negative following treatment, most people wouldn't repeat the PET scan, though if it is positive in the beginning and still positive after treatment, depending upon the degree of positivity, it may be worth doing down the road to sort of evaluate the disease. In terms of thinking about minimal residual disease, if that was the second part of the question that I interpreted accurately, there are molecular assays using something called polymerase chain reaction, PCR assays, looking for some discrete genetic features that are relatively unique to mantle cell lymphoma, and these have been mostly done in the context of clinical trials where physicians are trying to evaluate that minimal residual disease. And what minimal residual disease means is by CAT scan or PET scan, you don't detect any evidence of disease. As you heard Dr. Gopal mention just a moment ago, we can use some of these sensitive PCR assays to find the gene that might be present in your blood or in your bone marrow, and there's some data to suggest that patients who have no evidence of that genetic disease or are PCR negative for the mantle cell gene may do better than patients who are positive, and that once positive, there's some data to suggest from various studies that if you can treat them and make them negative, they do better than patients who remain positive. So those tests are highly specialized. Many hospitals actually don't do them. They have to be sent to specialized labs, but they're mostly done in the context of clinical research and clinical trials.
Excellent. Thank you very much. And we have time for this one more question. My brother tried ibrutinib for his refractory MCL and didn't work. He is now taking Velcade and Rituxan, but is quite sick. Are there any suggestions for clinical trials? We live in Northern California. Dr. Gordon, could you address that, please?
Yeah, so the response
rate. In a general way.
Right.
Because the specificity is a lot here. So.
Sure. The response rate with ibrutinib is about 70% or so, I mentioned, which is great and exciting. There are, that leaves about 30% of patients who are not going to respond. And so I can't say specifically if there are trials open in the Northern California area at Stanford and other places like that, but there are some trials looking at newer combinations, drugs like temsirolimus that I mentioned that's approved in Europe, maybe options for trials. Certainly Velcade and Rituxan is a good regimen, Velcade and Revlimid. Revlimid and Rituxan is a regimen that's been utilized. And so I think there are a number of options that would allow drugs that would mitigate some of the toxicities he's getting from the Velcade. But I think the thing to do would be, if living in Northern California, we'd look at the Stanford or UCSF institutions and see if they have an ongoing trial for which he'd be a candidate.
Thank you. And Ms. Eckhardt, would you want to comment just on the role of family sometimes and a brother, adult brother, actually, in just being supportive and the kind of services we offer here to family members as well, in terms of just clearly they play a very important role and support?
Well, sure. Well, family members are certainly many of our callers on the hotline, calling about their loved ones, asking about resources. We've talked a lot about clinical trials today, and of course the consensus is to speak with your doctor about those. And we often provide resources for how people can find the clinical trials. There's a few organizations that are out there that help to inform people of what's available, and then that can be then brought back to your doctor too. Go ahead, Carolyn.
I'm sorry.
Oh, no, sorry. I thought you were had something to add. But yes, family members, we provide that counseling right over the phone when they call the hotline. They're often the ones who are sitting in the rooms with their loved ones, listening to the doctors, and we provide that type of support with helping them to discover what type of questions would be a good idea in that session, and just having a place to vent about how it's been for them. Individual counseling, our groups, our caregiver groups, which I mentioned before, and these are certainly all the ways that we provide support for families.
Thank you, and we appreciate all the people on the call, both the people living with mantle cell lymphoma as well as their family members and siblings, adult siblings as well, who are so important as well. I want to actually thank all of our speakers. This has been an extraordinary call. I want to thank you all for your speaking. I want to thank all of you who queued up and asked questions, both on the phone and online. And I want to thank all of you who've been listening. And I want to say that this has been a very enthusiastic call, both by the speakers and by the wonderful questions that were asked. And I also hope that this has been helpful to you, and we hope that you'll take the information back to your treating healthcare team. In planning a program like this, we recognize that you all have many needs that go far beyond the scope of 1 hour. And with that in mind, I do want to remind you about the services of cancer care. You can contact us at 1-800-813-HOPE and speak with one of our oncology social workers. We have many here who can assist you with any concerns you may have or questions or information for resources or support group or practical and financial assistance as well. In addition, we also offer a lot of these workshops, and we also have a number of publications as well. So we have a very robust website, and I encourage you to visit our website as well. In addition, we don't want anyone to leave this call thinking that you're alone. I want you to know that you're now part of a very large community of support, and we're here to help you. We have a number of programs coming up both in May and June, and you all have access to that information. You are sent that information, and many of the programs that we're doing are general in nature, and so that they are actually maybe of interest to you. And so please do take a look at those programs and sign up for those that you think would be interesting to you as well. I want to thank you all for your participation today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop. You may now disconnect, and everyone, have a wonderful day.